Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome everyone, this is Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to discuss Central and Eastern Europe. My name is Maciek Makulski, I am a co-host of this show, and with me here as always is Adam Reichardt. Hello Adam.
Hi Maciek, hello listeners, welcome to episode number 30 of the Talk Eastern Europe podcast.
That's right, it's our 30th episode, we're glad we reached that number, and for today we have prepared, I think, very interesting topic for you. Maybe you can say something more about that, Adam?
Sure. This episode is going to be looking at we have an interview, a very special interview with our guest, Sean Walker, who is a journalist from The Guardian and spent many, many years as the foreign correspondent from Russia. So this is kind of our first, we do a lot of podcast discussions about the region and Russia's role in the region, but I think really this is the first time that we do a podcast about Russia itself, and we talk specifically about what is happening in Russia. So I think this is going to be a very interesting episode. There's so many different angles to look at when we talk about Russia, not only the role that it plays in geopolitics or the region of Eastern Europe or the Eastern Partnership countries, which it sees as kind of its sphere of influence, but also looking at the role that developments are happening on the domestic level, particularly with Vladimir Putin trying to maintain power, even though his term limit as president ends at 2024. So a lot of things to talk about, and finally we're actually going to look specifically, for the most part, looking at Russia and Sean's experiences as a reporter in the region.
One thing maybe to add here that we didn't discuss maybe in details the like current political developments in Russia, and we all know that it's quite hot period in Russia because there was very recently a change of the government in Russia, which is also discussed as a way or first step in changing power in Russia. But in this episode we rather focus on more macro processes in Russia, or what is the role of history in Russia and how Russia plays with it. But of course, in some future episodes, we will also talk about ongoing events or processes in Russia. Specifically.
Yeah, and if I can, Maciek, I do want to just recommend our listeners out there to check out the New Eastern Europe webpage, because we just published a commentary by a researcher and professor named Agnieszka Legutska here in Warsaw, and she outlines kind of the different scenarios that that may unfold in Russia in terms of Putin's plans for 2024. So we'll put a link in the notes to the podcast, but do check it out. There's some interesting discussion and interesting developments and scenarios which may give us some idea of what is happening for inside Russia and Putin's plans for maintaining power.
True. Agnieszka Legutska is one of the best experts on Russia in Poland, actually. So it's always worthy to read what she has prepared, and that's good. It's already available on NEE's website. So if we talk about New Eastern Europe website, maybe Adam, I can ask you if you may reveal what is inside the newest issue of New Eastern Europe, which was just published.
That's right. Just so everyone is aware, and I did post a link. If you're not a member of our Facebook group and you want to join, please do Do come over to www.facebook.com/groups/talkeasterneurope. I posted a link to our latest issue of New Eastern Europe, which we just published. It's coming off the press early next week, but we already have it online. And there's some very, very interesting pieces in there that I would like to just bring to the attention of our listeners. Most importantly, is it's a very interesting debate about the ongoing kind of calls from some in the West, for example, French President Macron calling for renewing strategic dialogue with Russia. So we decided to do a debate on what that means and how that would look, and is it possible? And we asked experts from the U.S., from France, from Germany, from Poland, and from Russia to give some commentary on what they think a renewed debate with or a renewed dialogue with Russia would look like. There's also a very interesting opening interview that I did with Brian Whitmore, who is the head of the Russia program at CEPA, the Center for European Policy Analysis in Washington, D.C. And we talk about a whole range of issues. He is an expert on the region, and it's and a very, very lively and dynamic conversation that I had with him, looking also particularly at Russia, but the mood in Washington, I think, is very important when we're talking about foreign policy in the region of Eastern Europe, and as well as some of his thoughts on countries like what's going to happen in countries like Belarus or Ukraine, Moldova. So I definitely recommend that our listeners and readers check that out as well. And a whole range of other texts. We'll put the link, I think, to the issue. I don't want to spend too much time going through it, but there's it's a big one. So a lot of content to go through. We have an excellent photo report from the front lines of the conflict in Ukraine. We have a discussion on Hungary. We have a discussion on looking at the economic situation in the Eastern Partnership countries, what the situation with Ukraine's oligarchs look like today under Zelensky. So really a ton of different topics and discussions and debates. So highly recommend heading over to www.neweasterneurope.eu and checking out our latest issue.
Sounds really great. To be honest, I haven't gone through all these materials yet.
Well, but, it's still fresh, yeah.
Yeah. But I'm sure it will be my long read for a weekend, since it's Friday at the time of recording this episode. Great, Adam. So maybe one more announcement from me. The one which is always available in our episodes, and I think one of the most important, about Patreon platform.
Yes.
So as always, we would like to encourage listeners to consider supporting us through the Patreon platform. We have prepared there some monthly plans, and each plan includes bonuses. One example is full digital access to New Eastern Europe magazine.
Yes.
So you can read not only current issue, but also check what is in archives. And you can find our profile at www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And special information about Patreon is that some time ago, Adam suggested a new goal for us to reach 20 patrons by January 2020.
Oh.
And at that time, I told to Adam it's rather unrealistic, but but he always knows otherwise. And today, on the last day of January, actually,
yes.
I must admit that we are very, very close to this goal, because we have 18 patrons.
18. Yeah.
At the time of recording, and
so
it
close.
Already
so close.
Sounds good to me. I would say it's close enough. So maybe the final call for listeners is, if you are listening now the podcast and you think you know someone who knows someone who might enjoy the podcast, just let him or her know. And even if I think the goal reached with a slight delay in early February is also valid, because let's not be so strict about deadlines.
Well, first, let me just add, Maciek, that the fact that we reached 18 is really impressive. And I want to just thank personally everybody out there who has donated to the podcast. It is really nice to know that you are out there, and the money that we do receive, it goes right back into the podcast. We have some ideas for the near future in terms of investing in the podcast, so stay tuned for that. Mm-hmm. And I think 18 out of 20, it's not bad. I am very satisfied that we managed to get that close to the goal. Even though it wasn't 20, I think, like you said, we can extend our goal slightly into February, and maybe we'll manage to get 20 before the end of February.
Yeah. So to conclude this part, let me, Adam, thank all our patrons by name.
Ah, yes.
And those are David, Dennis, Elizabeth, Erica, Ian, Jason, Janos, Kathleen, Mark, Pavel, Pierre, Sophia, Stephanie, Steve, Urs, Wilhelm, William, and Bartek. So once again, thank you very much.
Yes,
and we really appreciate that. And as Adam said, we really know what to do with this with these resources. And of course, we will inform you how we're gonna invest it very soon.
Great.
Okay. I think it's about time to go to the main part of this episode.
Yes.
And to listen to our interview with Sean Walker from Guardian.
Yeah, I think that just briefly to introduce our discussion. I mean, first of all, Sean is the author of a book titled The Long Hangover, Putin's New Russia and the Ghosts of the Past. He has spent a long time, as we mentioned in the beginning of the podcast, in Russia as a foreign correspondent. He started traveling to Russia immediately after he finished his early education. So he was learning about Russia already in the year 2000. So he has a lot of experience. And what we tried to do in our interview is to get both his reflections on personal reflections on his time being there, as well as some of his understanding of where Russia fits in the world today from his point of view, because he's been so deeply involved in the issues there.
Okay, so
anything else, Maciek, that you want to add before we move into the interview?
Actually not. So okay. I think we can continue with the interview.
Okay, so let's now move into the second part of the podcast, which is our interview with Sean Walker.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
So joining us now is Sean Walker, who is the Central and Eastern Europe correspondent with The Guardian. He previously spent more than a decade in Moscow as a journalist, reporter, and foreign correspondent. And he is the author of a recent book titled The Long Hangover, Putin's New Russia and the Ghosts of the Past, published by Oxford University Press and also recently published in Polish here in Poland. So, Sean, thank you so much for joining us and welcome to Talk Eastern Europe.
Hello, Sean.
Hi, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
If I may start, I would like to ask maybe a kind of get some of your background a little bit, because you spent over a decade, maybe even I would say how many years in Russia, nearly 20 years in Russia as a journalist and foreign correspondent. And I would like to ask perhaps what brought you to Russia in the first place, what got you interested there, what attracted you to Moscow, and what, when you look back at from today's point of view, 2020, a lot has changed from when you first went, and what are some of the reflections that you have when you have a moment to sit and think about your time in Moscow?
Sure. Well, so I initially went to Moscow when I was 18, and
wow,
sort of 6 months between school and university, and it was at that time it was a bit of a random choice. I'd read a few Russian novels. I was interested in some Russian music, and I wanted to do something in this 6 months, and Moscow seemed like a good mix of something that would be fun and exciting, but would also be challenging and a bit unusual. And it kind of turned out to be just that. And I mean, I arrived about, it was mid-January 2000. So it was literally a couple of weeks after Vladimir Putin had taken over the presidency. And I spent 4 months sort of very loosely, in inverted commas, teaching English in Moscow, and then spent a couple of months traveling around the country, which was, I didn't speak great Russian then. I was very young, but it was you could sense it was less than 10 years since the Soviet Union had collapsed. It was a sort of a very strange and fascinating, as an outsider, time to kind of see a country trying to work out where it was going and trying to discover itself. So I then went back to university, studied history, mainly Russian Soviet history at university. And then when I graduated, I went back to Moscow with the idea that I was going for a year to sort of sort out my Russian and to see what Moscow was like 4 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was actually working, first of all, for an NGO in Moscow, and then started kind of freelancing on the side, working for various different little publications in Moscow, and then gradually started working for The Independent, which turned into a more permanent thing. Did that for 5 or 6 years, and then worked for The Guardian for 5 years. So I have this kind of biography that's maybe much more common now than it was 20 or 30 years ago, mm-hmm. where you just sort of show up in a place and you kind of come to journalism through an interest in the place rather than being this correspondent who gets sort of moved around to different places.
Wow, yeah. Now that's a great story to hear. And what do you think about, like, when you look back at your first time to Moscow 20 years ago and how it is today? I mean, how much has changed from your perspective?
Well, it's interesting because there's certainly part of me that feels a bit envious of missing the years before when I arrived, because obviously I've basically watched the whole Putin era unfold, or well, let's say the complete Putin era up to this point. So I arrived just after he came in, and I left. I packed up my flat in Moscow after the World Cup in summer 2018. So
okay,
that was sort of 3 months after he'd just been reelected for another six years. So on the one hand, at the top, not much changed. And when I look back, had I been there for the previous 18 years of sort of arriving in late Brezhnev and leaving as Putin comes to power, that would have perhaps been a much more dramatic set of changes. But obviously, in that time, everything about the country changed and went through several iterations, from the sort of banal daily life factors of living in Moscow, which went from a sort of a wild city of extreme poverty and extreme wealth, no middle class, sort of, prostitutes on street corners, not knowing what's going to happen at any moment, to a city where, obviously still plenty of inequality, but somewhere that had actually become a pleasant place to live, somewhere that was full of people living quite pleasant lives, you know, going out for a walk with their family in the nice park, going to a reasonably priced restaurant, and sort of all the trappings of middle class life that weren't there before. And that's, you know, that's not just a Moscow-centric view. I think that that really did change in many, many Russian cities. So while, again, I mean, you don't have to go very far out of a major city to see something truly depressing or shocking, but at the same time, I think, you know, if, even if you go to Murmansk or Yekaterinburg or Irkutsk, you will find that there are sort of shopping malls and cinemas and things to do that weren't necessarily there 10 or 15 years ago. And of course, that comes from this oil wealth and comes from the better money of the first part of the Putin years, which I guess, you know, explains a lot of why many people support him. So yeah, I guess the sort of social and economic side of things changed. Politically, you know, by the time I started working as a journalist, it was already, I guess, 2007. So I missed that earlier period where there was this sense that perhaps, you know, we were perhaps some kind of end of history moment was going to happen, and Russia and the West were going to be friends, and Russia was going to join NATO and the EU and all this stuff, which was probably quite a brief period anyway. But you know, by the first big cut story I covered for The Independent was the Georgia War. And so we're really kind of already on versions, I guess, of the trajectory that we're on today, with sort of back and forwards and the reset, and so on. But I suppose, you know, while on the one hand, I guess since 2007, I've been writing these stories of sort of worsening relations and standoff with the West, and is this a new Cold War? I was always on the more skeptical side of that. And then, of course, what happened in 2014 just kind of rewrote all the textbooks and kind of changed dramatically. I think both Russia internally, yeah, and Russia's relations with the world.
Yeah, yeah, and actually, I would like to ask you about that in particular. And both Maciek and I have gone through your book, and we really enjoyed reading it. It's a nice read, and I recommend our listeners also to take a look.
Because
what I really liked about it is that it's full of detail, it's full of analysis, but at the same time, it's your personal stories and experiences, both in Russia, but particularly from Ukraine in 2014 and beyond. And I was particularly interested in the stories from your time in Eastern Ukraine during the really hot times of the war. And those must have been some really scary moments for you. You described particularly the one experience in Gorlovska with when you met the demon. Can you talk a little bit about what that was like for you as a journalist in a really dangerous situation?
Yeah, I can. I mean, so I think that was definitely sort of one of the hairiest moments of that kind of summer of 2014. And I mean, the reason that I included it in the book, because I didn't want this to be a book of sort of, you know, oh my God, I did such dangerous stuff in the war zone. Because I don't like that kind of journalism, and I hope it's not that like that. But what I found fascinating about the demon was kind of, he was a sort of extreme and perverse version of a character that you came across a lot in Eastern Ukraine. And so, you know, to briefly recap, yeah. So what I've got this Russian, one of my closest friends in Moscow, Marina Akhmedova, who has perhaps, I would say, a more pro-Russian view than I do. But so when we work together, I get access to a lot of people who probably wouldn't talk to me on my own. And so this guy, the demon, had a Russian mercenary volunteer, whatever you want to call him, who was fighting in his ranks and had read some of Marina's stories and asked her to come and do an interview. So we went there together, and we caught him on a pretty bad day. We arrived just as one of his fighters was being driven back in a sort of makeshift hearse, had been killed in a battle, and there was tension around the sort of makeshift headquarters. I think it was the old police headquarters in Gorlovka that they'd occupied. It was a pretty tense time. It was a couple of weeks, I think, after MH17 had been shot down. There was still a lot of heavy fighting in the area. And you could see that he was very tense. And yeah, we had this sort of slightly nightmarish scenario where we were meeting his prisoners of war downstairs, and then he came and we started asking him questions, and he took extreme offense to one of the questions that Marina had asked, and sort of
say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores led by Walmart and Target are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Lost the plot, started screaming, said, you know, they were going to search our stuff, execute us as spies. And it was one of these things where you sort of, I mean, a bit later, I convinced myself, okay, I mean, you know, lots of people were sort of bandying around threats in summer of 2014. And in general, they were empty threats. But there was something quite crazy about this guy. He clearly did have, I don't know if psychopathy is the right word, but there were, you know, he had done some terrible things, and you know, in the end he changed his mind, he let us go, we sort of ran away, but what I found super interesting about this was, so a year later I met one of the guys who we had briefly met in his basement, who was a Ukrainian from Gorlovka, who you know, it was sort of unclear, and you didn't want to ask too much when we were in this basement, if he'd really been working for the sort of Pravi sector, as he was accused of doing, or if he had simply been sort of rounded up. But he seemed like a nice chap. I heard a year later that he was released in a prisoner exchange, and I heard a year later he was back in the east of Ukraine working with the Ukrainian defense ministry. So I arranged to meet him in Slavyansk, which of course was, you know, the first town to fall to the separatists or the Russians, however you want to call it.
Yeah.
And it had been quite quickly liberated by the Ukrainian army. So this guy pops up and he's sort of swaggering with this pistol at his hip and combat outfit, and, you know, looks like a completely different guy to this guy that I met as a prisoner in the basement. And he was working on prisoner exchanges, and he was clearly very, very pro-Ukrainian, but he had a slightly, perhaps I would say, more nuanced view of what was going on. I guess when you've spent time on both sides, you change your approach a bit. And I started asking him about, it was like, you know, do you remember when I was there briefly last summer? And he said, oh God, yeah, how could I forget? I mean, I was convinced that you guys were finished. You know, the day before he'd executed someone.
Wow.
So that sort of brought back those memories. But then, you know, I started asking him about the demon, and so whose real name is Igor Bezler, and sort of saying, you know, God, what? So he was a complete lunatic then. And he said, well, yeah, no, there were some things that I saw while I was there that I would only talk about to like a war crimes tribunal. He did terrible things. And then he said, well, you know, by the way, I was Skyping him the other day. What? So, you know, by this point, it's summer 2015. Some of these people, like the demon, like Igor Strelkov, have been, you know, pulled away by Moscow, basically, because they're just too rogue to be reliable foot soldiers in this sort of proxy war. So Bezler is living somewhere in Crimea. I heard a rumor he was an undertaker. I don't know if that's true. But he's living in Crimea. And this guy, Budik, the prisoner, has been Skyping him. And he said, yeah, we've kept in touch, you know. Although he did all these terrible things, he was a pretty honorable guy. He was, you know, he was born in Donbass. He speaks Ukrainian. He could recite Taras Shevchenko in Ukrainian. You know, he served the Soviet military in Afghanistan. You know, he went through this trauma of the country that he swore an oath to breaking up. And not every person is strong enough to be able to deal with this. And I found that really interesting. And I mean, you know, you have to be careful, of course. So I've been following over the last couple of weeks on Twitter. There's this new book out about Radovan Karadzic, and a lot of people are sort of furious that it seems to be romanticizing him and sort of claiming that all these past things that happened to him led to the genocide in Bosnia. And I'm not suggesting that we should all feel really sorry for Igor Vesler and what a poor victim he is. Like, clearly he did some disgusting things and is a sort of awful person. But at the same time, I think the whole idea of the book was about how the sort of trauma of the Soviet collapse affected different people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think with someone like that, it clearly did have this effect that maybe brought out things that were already there. But just, you would hear this again and again from people who just sort of somehow threw everything into their lives and then felt that the sort of ground beneath their feet was pulled away and struggled to find it again. And perhaps there was an element of Stockholm syndrome with his prisoner, but I found it interesting that he had come out of this sort of 3 months in captivity with both a horror for what this guy had done, but a sort of general respect about his motives. He said, you know, in the 90s, this guy wanted to join the Ukrainian army, but the Ukrainian army was corrupt. There was no space for him. So he ended up going to Russia, fighting in Chechnya, and so on. And then he ends up back in his homeland, basically fighting for a foreign power.
Let's continue the discussion about your book and focus again on Russia. I wanted to ask a question about even the title of your book, The Long Hangover. And what do you refer to here? Let me maybe put it in this way. Like, what did Russia overdose on that it now has this hangover?
Well, yeah, I mean, I often get this question, and I'm not sure. The way it's often phrased is that, you know, you normally have a hangover after doing something very fun or having a big party. So, sort of, what was the party that Russia was recovering from? I mean, I think the basic idea of the book, which I wrote in the introduction, is you know, in one sense, it's an extremely obvious and banal point that, you know, yes, if a country collapses, if a system collapses, mm-hmm. It's going to affect, you know, the people and the politics of the place for many years. You know, if North Korea collapses tomorrow, I'm sure it's not going to suddenly sort of disappear from people's minds in a year or two. So, you know, that's obvious. But at the same time, I did feel that there was a sort of a strand of that legacy that we sometimes forget, and that in many ways I feel like almost every story that I wrote in 10 years from Russia was in some mm-hmm. way about sort of reformatting either internal politics or geopolitics or what mm-hmm. was going on inside people's heads, and filling that space from what had been lost or what had changed, or this kind of confusing moment of transition, which of course can later be manipulated and exploited. And I mean, I think you sort of see, I mean, in this new region that I work in now, you sort of have the same thing, right? These are mm-hmm. all countries where in 30 years they've had a chance or a necessity to sort of essentially create new national ideologies, new visions of the state. And I guess in very different ways, that's what you see happening with Viktor Orban, with Poland and Law and Justice and so on. And I think in the problem with the Russian case was, you know, you didn't quite have this quite simple thing that you could say in Poland or in in Estonia or in Latvia or whatever, where, okay, we had our independence, then it was taken away, now we've got it back. That's a celebration. We can build on this. You had this sort of confusing, messed up situation where, you know, are we supposed to be the more democratic version of the Soviet Union, or should we say that everything in the Soviet Union was bad? Should we look to Tsarist Russia, or was that also bad? Do we need to investigate the crimes of the past, or should we just move on? Are we an Orthodox state, or are we a multi-ethnic state with the Caucasus and the Tatars and so on? Mm-hmm. And sort of all these, we happen to be this massive country that stretches to the Pacific, but in time we're just going to become a normal European country and join the EU, or should we play up this weird sort of vague spiritual notion of the Russian soul and being a bridge between East and West? And kind of over the years, you have all these kind of ideas are being played with. There's never really a definitive answer. And so in a sense, the hangover was this sort of this long, confused attempt to deal with that legacy. And I think the one place in the book where I actually use the metaphor is in terms of dealing with the darker sides and the crimes of the Soviet past, which happened a little bit in the late 80s and the 90s, and then of course was sort of glossed over. And I sort of said it was a bit like, you know, you wake up with a horrible hangover and you look at the mess that's surrounding you, and you make a sort of cursory effort to clean it up, and then you think, actually, it's going to be much easier if I just go back to sleep. And so there was, you know, there was a bit of that in it. But I think it's really about this attempt to build a new identity. And my feeling was that Russia, and actually to some extent Ukraine, were the only two countries that had not, by the time we get to, say, 2010, 2014, that had not built a coherent, unifying vision of what their country was. So, you know, even in Central Asia, where they were sort of, you know, there was dictatorship, and some of these sort of, you know, the ancient Tajik or the ancient Kazakh elements of it were pretty much invented. They had there was this narrative of this is...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.
This is the ancient country. This is what we now are. In Russia, there was this confusion. In Ukraine, you sort of had lots of different narratives. Everyone in Ukraine, or almost everyone in Ukraine, perhaps with the exception of some people in Crimea, sort of would say, yes, I'm a Ukrainian. Yes, I feel Ukrainian. But there was no overarching idea of like, okay, well, what does it mean to be a Ukrainian?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So all of it is very important from internal point of view, and of course for Russia. But I also wanted to ask you, how do you perceive Russia as a country in international relations? Because my impression after reading your book was that the only solid basis for Russia is the country's past history, which now is being manipulated. And talking about such massive country as Russia, and with aspiration to play a global role, it's not much, I would say. So would you say that Russia now is a weak country as a political actor on a global scene?
I mean, Yeah, I think if you sort of I guess there are two parts to that answer. I mean, if you just look at numbers and statistics and demographics and budgets and so on, then obviously Russia is incredibly weak compared to the US or even some European countries.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, clearly, in the last few years, they have been able to insert themselves into the conversation to sort of make themselves a great player, I guess. Whether that's in the long term benefit of Russia, either objectively or even in the terms that Putin sees it, I don't know. You know, I don't know if it's useful for Russia to become a sort of, you know, this terrifying menace that everybody is accusing of everything, and now it's kind of so toxic that if you're a US or a European politician, it's difficult to want to sort of talk about building bridges with Russia. I'm not sure that's really very useful. Perhaps it's useful for domestic consumption, mm-hmm. but. I don't know. Again, I don't know how much longevity that has. So yeah, I think I make the point, which again I think is not a controversial one, is that I guess for Putin the idea of Russian importance is exactly that. It's not necessarily about recreating the Soviet Union or whatever, but it's mm-hmm. it's simply about feeling like you're a force that has to be taken into account, mm-hmm. and I think at different times he has felt that's best achieved by trying to cooperate with the West. At other times, and I think the more majority of the time, he's felt that's best achieved by laying down markers and showing where Russia's red lines are. I mean, you know, and then when you come to the other way round, I mean, mm-hmm. In terms of, so therefore, how should we deal with Russia? I mean, I find this tricky because I feel like there are these two sort of quite dogmatic camps, of which one says, you know, Russia only respects force, and the only way we can deal with Russia is to sort of, you know, lay down our red lines and make sure they know there are huge consequences for it. The other says, "Oh, Russia is this sort of poor, misunderstood. All this stuff is coming from a sense of insecurity. And if we're nice to Russia, they'll behave better."
Yeah. So maybe if we could look now domestically, also. I mean, I'm talking about the social conditions in Russia, which you had, I think, a chance to really observe, as we talked about in the beginning. I think, of course, the nostalgic attitudes towards the past are strong, as you describe in the book, and is as manipulated as we've been talking about in terms of history. But how do you assess kind of the condition of Russian society today? I mean, is it a state of stagnation, or do you think that there's even maybe fertile ground for an eruption of some sort of social rebellion? And we saw protests break out somewhat. It was quite interesting to observe last summer in Moscow regarding the Duma elections and not being able to have independent candidates, and seeing that there is some discontent at least in the bigger cities.
Yeah, it was very interesting. I mean, I took a 2-week trip back to Moscow last summer, and by chance it was just when those protests were going on. So it was interesting to see that. I mean, you know, this is the sort of question we've been asking for a long time, right? Like, at what point and how does this discontent manifest itself in a way that becomes impossible for the Kremlin to manage? I think it's a really difficult question. I mean, I think clearly there is huge, I mean, if there are two parts of it, I guess. There's huge discontent on any number of local issues. And so we've seen that with protests in really quite unusual places where you wouldn't expect to see protests, mm-hmm. about stuff like trash collection, about pension reforms and so on. So kind of hard economic issues. And I think that there is perhaps almost universal discontent about sort of social and economic issues in Russia. So you would go and talk to people, and I remember we made this little video for The Guardian in perhaps 2017-18, where I went to Irkutsk, and I remember talking to this woman on Lake Baikal who just, you know, ran on this litany of like the plumbing doesn't work and everything's corrupt and I hate it and my life is shit. And then it's like, so, you know, what do you think of Putin? Love him. Amazing. Like, you know, at least he's trying to sort this out. So it's that sort of stereotypical thing, which is very widespread. But then the second part of it is when does that stop happening? When does that support for him personally, start to cause problems? And we do see that declining, and we do see, I mean, you know, it is a remarkable sleight of hand when it comes to just sort of political technology, as the Russians call it, that, you know, 20 years after the guy is in office, he's still able to portray himself as part of the solution rather than part of the problem. But I think that is, it always has been, and I think it's more so again now, especially now the sort of so-called Crimea effect is wearing off. It's a very, very passive support. So, you know, if you look at, you know, you can measure support both in terms of numbers and in terms of how intense it is. And I think, you know, there's perhaps a small core of people who absolutely love Putin unconditionally, and there's a small core of people who despise him and will sort of fight to the end to remove him. But then you have this mass of people in the middle who, you know, yes, if you call them for the social survey and say, do you approve of Putin? They'll say yes, because, you know, as they see it, the alternatives are, you know, I don't know, someone else in the government who they don't like as much or know as much, or some kind of chaotic bloody revolution on the streets. And, you know, yes, given those options, we're going to go for Putin. And, you know, perhaps everything that the Kremlin has done over the last years to sort of stymie the opposition has meant that may well be true. I mean, it may well be true that, in order to overthrow this regime, something absolutely terrible would have to happen, and it may be awful. So, you know, for now, they've been able to sort of play this kind of, you know, fairground whack-a-mole game that every time sort of protest appears, you either, which we've been seeing recently, which is quite interesting over things like the journalist Ivan Golunov, like actually accede to the demands, or if it's a more general kind of more specific anti-Putin protest, to, you know, arrest a few people, make everybody scared of going out, have a few kind of outrageous court cases that show that, you know, you really could be risking going to jail for 10 years if you go out to this protest. And that's kind of worked. So the big question is, you know, when do we get to the stage where that doesn't work anymore, where there are enough people on the street that you can't arrest them all, where people are actually going to get, say, you know, someone's going to start smashing up a building or something like this, and, you know, you can't, there are 3,000 people involved and you can't sentence them all to 25 years in prison. And I think that question is very hard to answer. Is it going to be in 6 months or is it going to be in 15 years? It depends perhaps on the economic situation. It depends on Putin's health, mental health, how he tries to manage this 2024 situation, and all kinds of things. But certainly, you know, I think at the moment you still have this situation where those people in the people who would be sort of the vanguard of street protests certainly in Moscow and big cities still have much more to lose than to gain by, you know, escalating the protest to another level.
Let's switch again to Ukraine. You said before that up to 2010, Ukraine and Russia didn't solve the internal problems, how to construct the modern identity or narrative about the identity of the country. But especially after Revolution of Dignity, a new process or new era began in Ukraine, and taking into account the war between Russia and Ukraine, and that we have now a new president, a new government, which are for sure not pro-Russia ones. So, would you say that Ukraine finally has escaped from Russia's sphere of influence, or still there is a pro-Russia political camp strong enough in Ukraine and it might regain control again in some future?
I think so. Certainly the idea of the whole of Ukraine electing a government that openly professed sort of we need to be really good friends with Russia and orient ourselves more towards Russia than the EU is probably impossible, particularly as partly because of the war, partly because the lost Crimea and those territories that would have voted for that kind of thing. And certainly there's been a general change of mood in large parts of the country. I think what's interesting about Zelensky is, I don't know if he will succeed in terms of fighting the oligarchy, but he certainly...
Or corruption.
Yeah, exactly. But he certainly has a kind of interesting and newer, and I think kind of more promising take on Ukrainian identity, because the problem post Maidan was that you had lots of like wonderful people who'd done great things in Kiev saying we now have this new Ukrainian identity, and what Russia has succeeded in doing is created a new patriotic Ukraine that's firmly pro-Western. Well done, Russia. You've completely messed up. For a generation, we're going to hate you. And now we have this really strong, positive version of Ukrainianness. And on one hand, that was right. But then you'd say, okay, well, what about the 30-40% of the country that are patriotic Ukrainians in some sense of the term, but don't really buy into your vision of what that means? They're Soviet, they're Soviet hangovers, or they don't really understand or whatever. Like, basically, let's disregard them. And I think what Zelensky seems to be saying, I don't follow it now on a daily basis, but looking at his New Year's message, looking at the kind of rhetoric that he has used around the Second World War, that he's used around the Ukrainian nationalist movement, is that, there are spaces for all of these types of Ukrainian patriotism, that you can find Bandera a hero and that's fine, but you can also not find him a hero and that's also fine. And that, one or the other is not a prerequisite to being a real Ukrainian or having a true view of the past. And, maybe on the one hand, that's a bit of a cop-out, but on the other hand, in a country like Ukraine, where there are very different cultural and social backgrounds, that seems to me to be quite a sensible way of dealing with it. Mm-hmm. But to go back to your original question of whether it's out of Russia's orbit, the thing I always found about reporting in Ukraine is it's always this mix of like the most wonderful, exciting, like fresh, dynamic people trying to bring real change, and the most cynical, corrupt, like outrageous place you can imagine. And every time you would get hugely depressed about the cynicism, you'd meet some people doing some super things and you'd sort of fall back in love with Ukraine. Every time you got really excited about the people doing those things, you'd be assaulted by the cynicism and sort of get depressed. And I feel like that, there is this just by the virtue of the way politics have worked in the last 30 years, there is this class of business people, this class of politicians and the oligarchs who are very slippery, who will adapt to sort of any circumstances, who will change their ideology to sort of fit the mood of the day. And there is a risk that, with this kind of perhaps inexperienced young president who we know is close to one oligarch and this very young and fragile democracy, and the fact that there's still a war going on with Russia, without even mentioning the utter mess that America is dragging it into at the moment, there is always a risk that things could go wrong and Russia would only be too happy to capitalize. But it does feel like we're not really in a scenario where, in the next electoral cycle, a sort of Yanukovych type politician is going to come back and win an electoral majority. That seems to me to be pretty unlikely.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe this is a good segue then into our kind of last question, so we can start wrapping up the interview. But you're now covering politics and developments for The Guardian for the wider region of Central and Eastern Europe, if I understand correctly.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do you find yourself at all comparing your experience from Russia with what you see in kind of the wider region? Do you see similarities with what is happening both in Russia and other Central and Eastern European countries?
I mean, yes and no. So for sure, there are many similarities. And, you know, obviously for me now, it's been quite difficult to, obviously I spent a long time in Russia, I spoke the language, I felt like I understood everything. And now in this region where I'm dealing with a large number of countries that are all have, you know, there are similar, of course, historical circumstances and trends, but they're all very different. And I don't generally speak the languages. So it's been harder to sort of to really feel like I'm understanding places. But of course, I think both in terms of that historical legacy and in terms of politics, there are similarities. I mean, you know, looking at what's quite extraordinary about looking at, for example, Hungary and where I spend more time than any other country in the region. You know, when I look at what Orbán has managed to do in the last 10 years here, and it, of course, it's not. On the one hand, it's nothing like Russia. There is, you know, the opposition candidate just won the mayor of Budapest elections. But on the other hand, when you look at how, when I look at how kind of Hungarian state media functions, it doesn't look that different to Russian state media. When you look at the group of businessmen around Orbán and his family that have got hugely rich, it doesn't look that different to the Ozira collective around Putin, although of course it's on a smaller scale because of the size of the economy. And you look at that and you think he's done all of this and he hasn't actually had to kill anyone, put anyone in jail. You know, he's just sort of done it and people have accepted it, or because they're in the EU, they've left and found a life somewhere else. And, you know, in many ways, also, it feels harder to understand here because it was coming from a position where there were much more of the trappings of a functioning democracy than I think you ever had in Russia when Putin took over. So it's been kind of quite interesting to see how you can apply those Russia-style tactics here. And then I think, yeah, the broader point of just as we started off by saying this sort of, creating of national identities, and I mean, I think, you know, both Orbán and Kaczynski, perhaps with varying degrees of sincerity, but feel that, you know, their project is in some way linked to casting off the sort of effects and the legacies of communism in their own way. Yeah, I think in all these places, it's really interesting to see how politicians and societies go about conjuring up new ideas of what they are, what their countries mean, what they should stand for, what they, you know, what their place in the world should be.
Yeah. Well, Sean, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. Once again, Sean Walker is a Guardian correspondent for Central and Eastern Europe and a recent author of The Long Hangover: Putin's New Russia and the Ghosts of the Past. Sean, thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much.
And that was our interview with Sean Walker. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the podcast and for all your support and listening for all the other episodes. Make sure if you have not listened to our previous episodes, check out Talk Eastern Europe, which you can find on the New Eastern Europe website, but also on any app where you can find podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Podbean, and basically anywhere where you listen to podcasts.
There is any app that we are not available there and you like it, just let us know.
Let us know. That's right.
Yeah, one more time, I would like to encourage you to join our group on Facebook, where we try to feature discussion on the podcast and topics related to Central and Eastern Europe. Also, yeah. Those who use Apple Podcasts, do not forget to give us a rating there. And last but not least, many thanks also for your emails about the podcast and the feedback you sent to us. If we have not responded yet to all of us, we will do it soon.
Yes.
It was only because January, quite unexpectedly, is quite busy for both of us.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you, everyone. Let me just add to what Maciek said. It's great to hear from you, and we will respond. Plus, your ideas are giving us a lot of inspiration for the future episodes. And do rate us and comment on us if you can. On the apps that you use, I just want to say that Maciek, we currently have a 5-star rating on the Apple Podcast, so that's great to know.
Yeah, but we should keep it.
Yes, so help us keep it going. That's right.
Thanks.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks. Yep. Until next time, we will catch up soon.
Bye.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.